Ladies and gentlemen, your conference call is about to begin. Here is your moderator, Mr. Daniel Pipes.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone. It's my pleasure to introduce Gary Gamble in one of the Middle East Forum's more or less monthly conference calls dealing with current issues. Gary has a BS in mathematics from the University of Wisconsin, an MA in Arab Studies from Georgetown University, and a PhD all but dissertation from New York University. He's a former editor of a publication that the Forum put out earlier in the decade called the Middle East Intelligence Bulletin. He then edited the Middle East Monitor. He's worked for the Forum. He's now an editor. He's been a country analyst on Syria and Lebanon for Freedom House. You might recall Freedom House is one of the organizations now being persecuted in Egypt. Gary has specialized for some years and has prolifically written on Syria and Lebanon. And as Syria is the hotspot of many in the Middle East today, we thought it would be useful to have his thoughts on what's taking place and what U.S. policy should be towards it. Gary, over to you.
Thank you. I'd like to start with a little background on the strategic stakes in Syria that those who are considering what U.S. policy should be should consider. And the first one I want to start with, and this is not sufficiently recognized by a lot of people, is that Assad can't win. In the long run, there's no way that he's going to be able to pacify his country the way he did up until a year ago. And the reason for this is that the Syrian political system is a very unusual creature. It's the only majority Sunni Muslim country of the modern era to be led by a non-Sunni Muslim elite, in this case, Alawite. And this is a power structure that the evolution dates back to the colonial period when the French recruited non-Sunni sectarian minorities into the military and into the civil service. After Syria became independent, we had an evolution under Ba'athist rule from general dominance of minorities in Syria to specifically Alawite dominance. So the question is, how did a sectarian minority viewed as heretical by Orthodox Sunni Muslims, how did it come to rule over a majority Sunni population? And there were basically four factors, all of which have essentially disappeared. The first one is the Assad family relied upon the Arab world's most fearsome police state. We all know the stories of the infamous Hama massacre in 1982 when an estimated 20,000 Sunni Muslims were butchered along with most of the residential area of Hama. But beyond that, the Syrian regime has penetrated Syrian society far more than most other Arab governments. The only rival in this regard was Ba'athist Iraq. The second factor was what I would call distraction. In order to compensate for its lack of democratic legitimacy, the fact that it was essentially ruling over a majority ethno-sectarian group that has a 5-to-1 demographic advantage over Alawites. One of the factors was that it led a very anti-Zionist and anti-American foreign policy. This tended to co-opt radical Arab nationalists and Sunni Islamists and essentially divided the opposition and bought a certain measure of legitimacy there. The third one is appeasement by the outside world. Until recently, not only were Western countries not organizing opposition to Assad, but he basically got a pass from the rest of the predominantly Sunni Arab countries. And the fourth factor I want to mention quickly is that Assad has always relied not just upon the Alawite minority to rule, but relied upon other sectarian minorities in Syria, particularly Christians. And his ability to keep that support has always hinged on the alternative to his rule being much worse and on his ability to provide a certain measure of socioeconomic stability and security and have that favorably contrast with whatever the perceived alternative is. Now, The Arab Spring over the last year has essentially wiped away the first factor. To be sure, Assad still has the same fearsome security apparatus, but it's actually safer in Syria today to openly dissent against the regime. There's safety in numbers. A year ago, if you were to go out on the streets of any Syrian city and shout down with the regime, you would be the one person doing it, and you would be arrested and most likely dead. Today, you know, it's kind of a cliche, but that barrier of fear has been crossed. And so there's just no way that the 65% Sunni Arab majority in Syria is going to give up the fight. Second, Assad's ability to distract from the issue at hand by anti-Zionist adventurism or anti-American adventurism is very much washed up. And part of it is because it goes back to Syrian involvement in Lebanon, the killing of Hariri. He has essentially alienated Sunni Islamists and as well as moderate Arab governments over the past 3 or 4 years. Now, given that, given that at the end of the day he's going to lose, and you know, we can look at the military balance even as it stands now, without anybody openly arming the Syrian opposition. If you look at black market arms rates in Lebanon, the price of an AK-47 has like quintupled, because any spare gun on any border around Syria, whether it's Turkey, Lebanon, they're pouring into Syria. The opposition is getting stronger by the day. It is probably a long way from being able to oust the regime, but the direction things are moving seems to me pretty inexorably moving against Assad. In other words, this is the best that it's ever going to get for him. So the question, the next question that arises is, should we be trying to accelerate this process, accelerate the breakdown of the regime? And the question that arises there, one is, can we accelerate it? Does overt Western intervention in Syria, what impact is that going to have? Is it going to enable Assad to cast what is essentially a sectarian conflict as a conflict of the Arab nationalists versus the West? Is it going to enable Iran to legitimize its intervention in Syria to its own public if the United States is involved? But the more important question, I think, is not even whether we can accelerate the process of regime breakdown, but should we? And the reason I ask that is that consider the status quo. You know, this thing could drag on for months, maybe 6 months, maybe a year. And what is the strategic impact of that going to be? In my view, the situation we have now, where a Syrian regime that ultimately can't win but can't back down and only has oppression and greater violence as a strategy, is steadily, on the one hand, it's steadily alienating its own base of support. My guess is that six months from now, Assad's public support for Assad in Syria is going to bottom out even more than it has now, and that's not going to get better. The second factor, though, is that the more this sectarian conflict endures, the more bloody it gets, the more the Arab states are going to be moved to intervene, the more the Arab states are going to come into conflict with Iran. And traditionally, the Gulf Arab states have sort of gotten us to confront Iran for them. This is very evident in Lebanon, where the Bush administration sort of took the lead in confronting Hezbollah, took the lead in being the bad guy, while the Saudis pretended to, like they were mediating between Hezbollah and Prime Minister Hariri, for example. When in actuality, it was really, you know, if you go back and talk to the people involved in Lebanon policy at the time, it was the Saudis that were pushing us to confront Iran and Lebanon all along. This is a unique situation where, if we do nothing, the surrounding Arab states, and probably Turkey as well, are not going to let Assad gain the upper hand. they're going to have to enter the arena and contest Iran for control of Syria. And there's some value to letting that play out, letting this sort of long-awaited confrontation between Arab states and Iran, let it take place. Obviously, we should be concerned if the humanitarian costs in Syria reach catastrophic levels. But at the same time, we shouldn't be looking for a way for Iran and the Arab states to work out a compromise, especially one that's not going to lead to democracy and freedom for the Syrian people. And that seems to be the policy of the Obama administration now. There have been reports in the last couple of days that the Obama administration is telling Assad's lieutenants, get rid of Assad and you can stay on. We'll support a reconciliation with the opposition. There seems to be a belief that somehow we can shortcut this looming regional confrontation in Syria. And it looks to me like there's really no way for us to do that. So the proposition that I would make is that if Assad is going to lose anyway, if this is eventually going to lead to the consolidation of a Sunni-led government that takes Syria out of Iran's orbit, then there's really no rationale for us to get involved. Getting involved can only lead to entanglements that we're going to regret. It's very possible Syria could be what Lebanon was in the 1980s, a focal point for regional and international proxy wars. And so long as this advances our strategic interests, we shouldn't be looking for a way to circumvent that path.
Thank you. Let me start with a couple of quick questions. First, do you see prolonged fighting in Syria as having an impact on the Iranian population and making them more unsettled? And second, do you see this leading to exacerbating the differences between the Turkish and Iranian governments?
Well, as for the impact it's going to have on Iran, I think that's less clear, and I would add that I'm not an expert on Iran. My concern is that insofar as this is going to become a fundamentally sectarian struggle between, well, first and foremost, between Sunnis and Alawites, but more broadly between Sunnis and heterodox Muslim minorities in the Middle East, I wouldn't jump to the conclusion necessarily that the Iranian people are not going to feel a certain amount of communal solidarity if it comes to that. I do think that Turkey and Iran are clearly competitors in Syria. But we have to remember that at the end of the day, a Turkish victory in Syria is sort of a Pyrrhic victory, because of course Turkey is led by an Islamist regime, specifically a Sunni Islamist regime. And one of the other concerns I would add about intervention is that any kind of intervention in the form of a no-fly zone or UN Security Council resolutions legitimizing buffer zones or the like, that's ultimately going to boost Turkey's regional stature, boost Turkey's claim to regional leadership. And so I'm not necessarily sure we should be moving wholeheartedly in that direction either.
Okay, thank you. Bonnie, let's open it up to questions.
Okay, thank you. To join the question and answer session queue, press star 1 on your telephone keypad. I will announce each caller prior to bringing you into the conference. Please remember, if you have your phone on mute, take it off mute when you are selected to ask your question. Again, to join the question and answer session queue, press star 1 on your telephone keypad. And our next question comes from the line of Mr. Harvey Lippman.
Thank you. Allow me, if I may, to give a contrarian view, and I'd like you to respond to this, which is that it's better for Israel to have Assad in power for two reasons. One is that the border between Israel and Syria has been quiet. He is someone that honors, for his own self-interest, a ceasefire with Israel for however long it's been, 30 years or something like that. Second reason is that while we all know that Assad is bad and aligned with Iran and we'd like to break that axis, if you will, at the same time, the Sunnis who take over may be, to, for lack of a better word, may be Al-Qaeda-oriented, and the regime that takes power in Syria, as bad as Assad is, may even be worse for Israel.
Okay. That's actually two very good points. But what I would add is, taking the second one first, yes, there's a concern, any post-Assadian regime is going to be dominated by Sunni Islamists. But I would refer you back to the point I made about the diversionary survival strategy of the Assad regime. Because the Assad regime was led by a small agrarian minority that viewed as heretical, and just in terms of socioeconomic status, until the Ba'athists came to power, were just basically an underclass. Alawite families used to send their daughters into Damascus to be maids for the Sunni upper bourgeoisie. And now that, and in order to compensate for that, in order to compensate for dominating the majority Sunni population, something that is so intolerable to Orthodox Sunni Muslims there's really no equivalent, because Alawites are actually more schismatic than Shiites. They're sort of an offshoot of an offshoot. In order to maintain that system, he had to be holier than the Pope when it came to Islamist causes, when it came to confronting Israel. A Sunni Islamist regime It is not going to face that dynamic. It's not going to need to be more radical than the population at large.
I've compared an Alawi ruling Syria to a Jew becoming Tsar or an untouchable becoming a Maharaja. Just basically unthinkable, and yet that's been the case for over 40 years.
Right. Referring to your first question, that's a very good point, except that it's not a choice between Assad or the opposition anymore. As I said, Assad can't win. Assad is never going to be in a position to offer anything to Israel. So in a way, that ship has sailed. So it's not, some people are objecting to intervention, saying, we don't know what we're going to get. We do know what we're going to get. It's not going to be as bad as this dysfunctional Alawite-led dictatorship. And in any case, I don't know that there's a whole lot we can do to change that trajectory. The best I think we can do is hope that in the transition from the Assad regime to whatever comes after it, that the transition, I guess, is as short as possible, as little destabilizing to the region as possible. And one of the best ways to ensure that is to sort of let things go on the way they are. The rate that the Assad regime is killing its predominantly Sunni constituents and overwhelmingly Sunni demonstrators is a huge albatross for the Iranians. I mean, not to mention for Assad himself. It's ultimately a losing strategy. Public support can only go down for the regime. So there's something to be said for, let this play out longer. If there's nothing we can do decisively to improve upon the status quo, which, as I said, is strategically an albatross for the Iranians, if there's nothing we can do to improve upon it, barring a major humanitarian catastrophe, I say let it play out.
Okay, our next question comes from the line of Mr. Jeremy Rosenblum.
Hello. I had two questions. I was wondering if you, what level of concern you have that Assad may try to launch a diversionary war against Israel, in part in order to justify more repression at home or to distract his population. And secondly, do you think there's anything conceivable that the United States or Western governments could do to encourage any succession or any role for less extreme alternatives to the Assad regime?
Okay. On the first one, I've been debating this question myself, and my tentative conclusion is that I wouldn't expect diversionary attacks on Israel, i.e. through Hezbollah, partly because if you look at Hezbollah's situation in Lebanon, the uprising in Syria has really, it hasn't actually changed the political balance in Lebanon in terms of who's holding power, but it has very much changed the tide of public opinion. And I think that Hezbollah knows that now is not the time for non-Sunni minorities to be trying to stir up trouble in the Middle East. As for Assad, that ship has kind of sailed too. You know, one of the things we learned from the Egyptian uprising is that ultimately, you know, for a long time it was believed that, you know, until we solve the Arab-Israeli conflict, you know, the Arabs are never going to rise up against their rulers, that, you know, they're too, too imprisoned by revanchist anti-Israeli sympathies. It turns out intolerance and hatred of the current regimes is a much stronger force. But I, you know, it would be very risky for Assad. Apart from that, it would also be more likely to invite Russia, I think, and China from abandoning their support for the regime. I think Assad doesn't have the freedom. You know, certainly Iran doesn't want to blow up into a major regional conflagration, I don't think. But I think that's an open question. The truth is we don't really know. I mean, Assad has not always acted rationally in the past. So, I'm sorry, what was the second question?
Oh, I'm sorry, he's muted again. Okay, so we'll go to our next question from the line of Mr. David Edmund.
Yes, hi. The conventional wisdom is that a change in Syria will have a detrimental impact on Iran. And my question is, you know, just from a very practical perspective, you know, how... Is that the case, and what is the practical impact upon Iran? And also on the other side, you mentioned a little bit Lebanon, Hezbollah, and Hamas. What happens with those actors in that area?
Right. Okay. Well, there's two tracks here. One, the replacement of regime by a majoritarian Sunni-led regime, any majoritarian Sunni-led regime, is going to break the alliance with Iran. That's going to cut off Iran's ability to transship weapons to Hezbollah in Lebanon. So everybody sort of agreed that once the dust settles, any successor regime in Syria is going to be better strategically in that regard. But I would argue that even before the dust settles, Iran is taking a beating. You know, at the end of the day, the loss of Syria, Syria is never going to be a stable, unitary country again under Assad's rule. So Iran's never really going to get the benefits that it once got from the alliance. That ship has sailed. Its futile efforts to preserve that or to try to regain it could end up compounding the damage. Because again, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, Hezbollah Secretary General Hassan Nasrallah was easily the most admired public figure in the Arab world. Majority of Iranian citizens in I think, every country but Saudi Arabia publicly supported Iran's pursuit of nuclear weapons. I think that's going to change if this imbroglio in Syria endures. It's, you know, again, if an Iranian-backed regime is butchering Sunnis, not Sunnis that are armed by the West, not Sunnis that are somehow in league with enemies that, that can be, you know, whether it's the United States or Europe, as long as that endures, I think it's bad for Iran in the interim. And then, of course, when all is said and done, Iran's going to lose out as well.
Okay, and that is all the questions that we have at this time.
We have just a couple more minutes. Let me ask you, Gary, what you think this will do in terms of American standing in the region. Is it overall a plus? I mean, arguably Egypt and Tunisia were states that we could work with. Libya, more or less, we could work with. Syria, we couldn't work with. Is this to our advantage, or is the instability that's going to follow a quagmire, a source of, you compared it to Lebanon, a source of problems?
I think it's tough to say, but people use the term quagmire as if to suggest that a long period of instability and regional competition for supremacy in Syria is going to work against us. It may well be that the longer this drags on, we're already at a point, I think, where a lot of Arabs are coming to the conclusion that the first step towards solving their problems of revitalizing their civilization is not confronting Israel or trying to destroy Israel, but getting their own house in order. The uprising in Syria has demonstrated that in the heart of Levant, it is Iran that is standing in the way of that kind of self-determination, not Israel, and certainly not the United States. So as long as that is the focal point of regional strategic contention, I don't see how that works to our disadvantage.
Well, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. The Middle East is a hot spot. Every month we have analysis for you of current issues. I want to thank you, Gary Gamble, and thank you all for joining us today, and catch you soon again. Goodbye.